A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the non-profit sector. Not just what it does, but where it came from. He wants to know if there's a common lineage between ancient patronage systems, the ones that funded cathedrals and frescoes, and the modern non-profit world of think tanks, open-source foundations, and cause-driven organizations. Is there a thread that connects a Medici bankrolling Brunelleschi to the Apache Software Foundation stewarding a web server? He's also asking how large the sector actually is today, and specifically about the long tail of smaller organizations most of us never hear about, both in the US and globally. So let's trace this lineage from a Medici bankroll to a 501c3 filing and see what connects them.
The nonprofit sector is one of those things that's everywhere once you start looking. Charities, foundations, think tanks, hospitals, universities, open source groups like Apache and Mozilla, they all share a basic structure. They exist to advance a mission, not to generate profit for owners. But the question Daniel's asking gets at something deeper. Are these organizations the modern expression of something ancient, or did the legal and economic machinery of the last century create something genuinely new? And if it's both, where's the seam?
Right, because on the surface, a Renaissance patron commissioning a chapel and a foundation, issuing grants for climate research, look like completely different animals. One is a guy with a name on a building, the other is a tax-exempt entity with a board and a mission statement. But the impulse underneath, using private wealth for something that doesn't turn a profit, that's the same impulse. It's the same basic wiring.
And that's the tension. Is there a continuous lineage, or are we just seeing the same human impulse reinvent itself in different eras with different tools? I think the answer is both. The impulse is ancient, but the formal nonprofit sector as we know it is surprisingly young. The legal category is barely a century old. What we're really looking at is an old instinct that got a new operating system.
So let's go back to the beginning. What did patronage actually look like, and how did it morph into the nonprofit we recognize today? If I'm a Florentine banker in 1400, what am I actually doing when I fund the chapel?
Patronage in the ancient and medieval world wasn't philanthropy in the modern sense. A patron, whether it was a Roman senator, a Florentine banker, or a Chinese emperor, funded art, architecture, and scholarship for a mix of reasons. Prestige was huge. You wanted your name on something that would outlast you. Religious salvation was another driver. Funding a chapel or a monastery was literally an investment in the afterlife. And there was civic pride, the sense that a great city should have great buildings. But underneath all of that, there was also a very practical concern. Patronage was how you demonstrated that you were a person of consequence. It was social signaling before anyone called it that.
The Medici didn't fund Brunelleschi's dome on the Florence Cathedral, because they'd run a cost-benefit analysis on urban renewal. They wanted everyone in Florence to know who made the skyline possible. And it worked. 500 years later, we're still talking about them.
And Brunelleschi's dome is a perfect case study. Filippo Brunelleschi got the commission in 1418. The dome was an engineering problem nobody had solved. How do you build a dome that size without it collapsing during construction? The Medici bankrolled it, and the result defined the Florence skyline. But the Medici got something in return, political legitimacy, social status, and a direct line to the church. It was transactional, just not in cash. The return on investment was measured in influence, not florins.
It's also worth noting that the dome wasn't a sure thing. Brunelleschi's design was controversial. There were rival architects who thought it'd fail. The Medici were taking a real risk. If the dome had collapsed, they'd have been the family that funded the disaster. So there's an element of calculated risk-taking that feels almost venture capital adjacent, except the exit strategy is get into heaven.
That's a great parallel, actually. The patron as early-stage investor in cultural production, and like venture capital, the hits were spectacular and the misses were quietly forgotten. For every dome that defined a skyline, there were probably a dozen frescoes that nobody remembers, funded by patrons whose names are lost to history.
So the proto-nonprofit impulse is there, private wealth funding a public good. But the motivations are tangled up with ego, politics, and theology. It's not clean, and it's not really charity in the sense we'd use the word today.
And that's the first misconception worth busting. Ancient patronage wasn't purely altruistic, and neither is a lot of modern philanthropy. The motivations were mixed then, and they're mixed now. What changes is the structure around the giving. The scaffolding, as we keep saying.
So where does the structure come in? When does this shift from a guy writing a check to a formal organization that outlasts the guy?
The 19th century is the pivot point. You start seeing charitable trusts and foundations that institutionalize giving around a mission, not just a patron's whim. The Peabody Trust in Britain, founded in 1862 by George Peabody, built housing for the poor in London. It wasn't just here's money for a statue, it was a structured, ongoing effort with a specific social goal. Peabody wasn't just buying a thing, he was trying to solve a problem.
And he was an American, right? A banker who moved to London?
Yes. And that's part of the story, too. The transatlantic flow of ideas about philanthropy. Peabody took American ideas about structured giving and applied them in London. He was a bridge figure.
And Carnegie?
Andrew Carnegie is the textbook example. Between 1886 and 1919, he funded over 2,500 libraries across the United States and around the world. But here's the key. He didn't just write checks. He had a system. A community had to apply, provide the land, and commit to funding the library's operations through local taxes. Carnegie provided the building and the books. It was conditional, structured, and designed to be self-sustaining. He wasn't just giving away money, he was building an engine that would keep running.
He was building a platform, not just buying a painting. And the platform had rules. You had to show skin in the game.
Right. And that's a huge conceptual shift. Patronage becomes programmatic. The patron isn't just funding a thing, they're funding a system that's supposed to keep working after they're gone. Carnegie's libraries are still operating today, more than a century later. Some of them have been repurposed as community centers or museums, but the buildings are still there, still serving the public. That's not Medici. That's something new. That's infrastructure thinking applied to philanthropy.
But it's still private wealth, still a guy with a name on the door. The legal framework that turns this into a sector, that comes later. How do we get from Carnegie writing checks to a whole category of tax-exempt organizations?
1917. The U.S. federal income tax was only 4 years old at that point, and Congress introduced the charitable deduction. The idea was that donations to charitable, religious, and educational organizations should be tax deductible. Suddenly, there's a financial incentive baked into the tax code for giving. That's the moment the nonprofit sector starts becoming a formal economic category. The government is effectively saying, if you give money to certain kinds of organizations, we'll treat that money differently.
Wait, so the charitable deduction is older than the nonprofit sector itself? The incentive came before the definition?
In a sense, yes. The deduction created the incentive before the sector had a clear legal definition. That definition came later, and the big one was the 1969 Tax Reform Act. That's when Congress formally distinguished between private foundations and public charities. Private foundations, like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation, are typically funded by a single source, like a family or a corporation. Public charities get their support from a broad base of donors. The 69 Act imposed different rules on each, including payout requirements for foundations and restrictions on self-dealing.
Self-dealing being?
A foundation giving money to its own founders or board members in ways that benefit them personally. Before 69, you could set up a foundation, donate assets to it for the tax deduction, and then essentially still control and benefit from those assets. You could park your money in a foundation, take the tax break, and then use the foundation's resources to buy art for your living room or pay your relatives' consulting fees. The Act closed that loophole. It professionalized the sector.
So the 69 Act is basically saying, if you want the tax benefit, you have to actually give the money away. You can't just cosplay as a philanthropist while keeping control of the assets.
And that's a watershed moment. It draws a bright line between, I'm giving money away, and I'm managing my wealth in a tax-advantaged way. The sector gets a skeleton.
So by 1969, the nonprofit sector has a legal skeleton. It's not just rich people being generous. It's a regulated category with rules about governance, transparency, and accountability. And that skeleton enables what comes next.
And that legal skeleton is what enables the explosion of the sector in the 20th century. You get think tanks, advocacy groups, professional associations, organizations that aren't charities in the traditional sense of feeding the hungry, but that advance causes, shape policy, and produce knowledge. The nonprofit form becomes a vehicle for ideas, not just services.
Brookings.
The Brookings Institution was founded in 1916, actually before the big legal changes, but it set the template. Robert Brookings was a St. Louis businessman who wanted to create an institution dedicated to impartial policy research. The idea was that government needed expertise, and a nonprofit research organization could provide it without the profit motive distorting the analysis. He was essentially saying, democracy needs a brain, and the market won't provide one on its own.
Impartial might be doing some heavy lifting there, but the motto caught on. And once Brookings exists, it creates a kind of arms race. If one side has a think tank, the other side needs one too.
It absolutely caught on. The Heritage Foundation was founded in 1973 explicitly as a conservative counterweight to what its founders saw as a liberal policy establishment. And this is where you see the nonprofit sector becoming a battleground for ideas. Think tanks aren't just doing research. They're advocating, shaping legislation, building coalitions. The nonprofit form becomes a vehicle for political influence. It's not just about feeding the hungry anymore. It's about feeding the policy machine.
Which is a long way from Brunelleschi's dome. The patron is no longer an individual. It's a network of donors funding an organization that exists to shift policy. The public good being advanced is contested. One person's vital research is another person's propaganda, and they both have the same tax status.
And that tension is built into the sector's DNA. The legal framework doesn't judge the mission, it judges the structure. As long as you're organized as a nonprofit and your activities fall within the IRS guidelines, you get the tax exemption. Whether your mission is feeding the hungry or advocating for lower taxes, the structure is the same. The IRS doesn't ask, is your mission good? It asks, are you following the rules?
Which is both a strength and a weakness. It means the sector can accommodate a huge range of activities, but it also means the category itself doesn't tell you much about what an organization actually does.
Right. Nonprofit is a tax status, not a moral category, and that's something people often miss.
So we've gone from Medici to Carnegie to Brookings. Where does open source fit into this lineage? Because that feels like a different branch entirely.
This is where it gets really interesting. The Apache Software Foundation was founded in 1999. The Mozilla Foundation was established in 2003. These are nonprofit organizations that steward public goods and software. Apache hosts hundreds of open source projects, including the Apache web server, which at one point ran something like two-thirds of all websites on the internet. The infrastructure of the web was built and maintained by a nonprofit.
And the patronage model here is what? Corporate sponsors? Individual donations? It doesn't look like Carnegie writing checks for libraries.
Partly. Apache and Mozilla get funding from corporate sponsors, individual donations, and sometimes earned revenue from services. But the governance model is different from traditional nonprofits. Apache is a meritocracy. Contributors earn commit access by doing good work over time. The foundation provides legal and organizational infrastructure, but the direction of projects is driven by the community of developers. It's patronage without a patron. Or rather, the patron is so distributed that no single entity can steer the ship.
Well, the patron is distributed. Instead of one Medici, you have thousands of contributors and dozens of corporate sponsors. The public good is the code base, and the nonprofit exists to protect it from any single entity capturing it. The foundation is a shield.
And that's a direct evolution of the lineage. The impulse is the same. Private resources funding a public good, but the governance is radically different. No single donor can tell Apache what to do. The foundation's structure insulates the projects from any one funder's agenda. That's a genuine innovation over the Carnegie model, where the patron's vision shaped everything. Carnegie decided where libraries went and what the rules were. Apache can't decide what features get added to the web server.
Although Carnegie's libraries outlasted Carnegie. The structure he built kept working after he was gone, so maybe the difference is less about longevity and more about who gets to steer while the thing is alive.
That's fair, and it connects to the modern tension in the sector, the pressure to professionalize, to measure outcomes, to scale. Carnegie could just decide to build libraries. A modern foundation has to demonstrate impact, meet payout requirements, satisfy a board. The act of giving has become an industry, and an industry needs metrics.
All right, let's zoom out. You mentioned the sector has become an industry. How big are we talking? What's the actual scale here?
The numbers are striking. In the United States, there are over 1.5 million registered nonprofits, according to IRS data compiled by the Urban Institute's National Center for Charitable Statistics. The sector contributes roughly 5 to 6% of U.S. GDP. That's on the order of the entire retail sector. We're not talking about a niche. We're talking about a major component of the economy.
0.5 million. That's a lot of mission statements. How do you even wrap your head around that number?
And here's the thing Daniel was getting at, the long tail. The sector is dominated by a few enormous players. Hospitals, universities, and large foundations account for the bulk of the assets and revenue. But the vast majority of nonprofits are tiny. Most have annual budgets under $500,000. Many are entirely volunteer-run. They're local food banks, after-school programs, community theaters, animal shelters. They're the organizations you've never heard of unless you live in their zip code.
So the sector looks like a power law distribution. A handful of giants and then a very long tail of small organizations that most people have never heard of. The Gates Foundation and the local cat rescue occupy the same legal category.
The top 1% of nonprofits by revenue, the universities, the hospital systems, the Gates Foundation, they command a huge share of the sector's total resources. The Gates Foundation alone has an endowment of something like $50 billion. Meanwhile, a local soup kitchen is operating on $100,000 a year, and the executive director is also the janitor. Same tax form, completely different universe.
That's the tension between mission and sustainability you mentioned. The small organizations are closest to the ground, most connected to the communities they serve, and also the most fragile. They're one bad grant cycle away from disappearing.
They face a brutal fundraising environment. The professionalization of the sector means donors expect metrics, impact reports, strategic plans. A tiny organization running an after-school art program has to compete for grants against organizations that have dedicated development staff. The pottery kiln needs a logic model. And the person who knows how to run the kiln probably doesn't know how to write a logic model.
That's grim, actually. The very thing that makes these organizations effective. They're embedded, they're informal, they know their community, is what makes them look unprofessional to funders. The system selects for people who are good at grant writing, not necessarily people who are good at running after-school art programs.
It echoes the patronage era in an uncomfortable way. Under the Medici, the artist's sustainability depended entirely on the patron's continued favor. Today, a small nonprofit's sustainability depends on grant cycles and donor relationships. The dependency is still there, it's just bureaucratized. Instead of one patron you have to keep happy, you have a dozen grant officers.
The lineage is real, but it's not all progress. Some of the old problems just put on a tie. The power asymmetry between the funder and the funded hasn't gone away. It's just been spread across more people and more paperwork.
Right. And the global picture adds another layer. The U.S. model is unusual in how much it relies on private philanthropy. In much of Europe, the nonprofit sector is more tightly integrated with the welfare state. Organizations often receive significant government funding and deliver services that in the U.S. might be handled by private charities, or, well, not handled at all. The line between nonprofit and government contractor gets blurry.
And in developing countries.
It's a mix of large international NGOs, local community-based organizations, and everything in between. The long tail exists everywhere, but the funding ecosystems are different. In some places, the nonprofit sector is heavily dependent on foreign aid. In others, it's driven by diaspora remittances or local philanthropy. The legal frameworks vary enormously, too. Not every country has a 501c3 equivalent, and the tax treatment of charitable giving differs widely. Some countries don't have a charitable deduction at all.
The US didn't just invent the non-profit sector. It invented a specific flavor of it, and that flavor has been exported through international NGOs and foundation funding. But it doesn't always translate cleanly to other contexts.
Through open source. The Apache and Mozilla models are now global. The Linux Foundation hosts projects with contributors from every continent. The nonprofit form has become the default governance structure for digital public goods. It's not just about charity anymore, it's about infrastructure. The internet runs on nonprofits.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about lineage. If the Apache Software Foundation is a descendant of the patronage system, what's the family resemblance? What would a Medici recognize if they looked at Apache?
The family resemblance is this: private resources, voluntarily contributed, stewarded for a purpose that isn't profit. The differences are in governance, scale, and accountability. A Medici patron answered to no one. The Apache Software Foundation answers to its members, its board, and the IRS. Its patronage democratized. The impulse is the same, but the power structure has been turned inside out.
Democratized and anonymized. Nobody's putting their family crest on the Apache web server. The contributors are often pseudonymous. The glory is distributed, or absent entirely.
Although, some corporate sponsors do get their logos on the Apache website. It's not a fresco, but it's not nothing. The instinct to be recognized for funding something important that hasn't gone away. It's just been scaled down to a logo on a sponsorship page.
The Medici would understand the instinct, even if they'd find the execution baffling. A logo on a web page doesn't quite have the same impact as a dome visible from every hill in Tuscany.
They'd probably ask about the tax deduction.
They'd love the tax deduction. Imagine explaining to Cosimo de' Medici that if he donates to a 501c3, he can reduce his taxable income. He'd be setting up foundations before you finish the sentence.
Before we wrap, Hilbert's been itching to share something from his own brush with the nonprofit world. Hilbert, you spent time in the trenches?
I wrote grants in the late 90s. Tiny outfit, after-school art programs, rural county. We had a pottery kiln that kept breaking. I wrote a $5,000 grant to replace it. Took me 3 weeks.
3 weeks for a kiln? That's a lot of hours per dollar.
The application was 30 pages. They wanted a logic model. For a kiln, I wrote that the kiln would build community resilience through creative expression. The kiln just needed to get hot enough to fire clay. But the grant application didn't have a box for, "The old kiln is broken and we need a new one."
Did you get the grant?
We got it. Kiln lasted 2 years, then the heating element went and I had to write another one. Same process, same logic model, slightly different synonyms for resilience.
You were a professional kiln grant writer. That was your job.
Among other things, the founder was a retired banker. Put up the first use funding out of his own pocket. Modern Medici, I guess. Then the IRS audited us.
For a $5,000 grant? That seems disproportionate.
The audit wasn't about the money. It was about whether we were really a public charity or a private foundation dressed up wrong. We'd been filing the wrong form for 2 years. The banker had set it up himself without a lawyer. He'd read a book about starting a nonprofit and figured he could handle the paperwork.
It happened.
We refiled. Paid a small penalty. The IRS agent was actually helpful once we got through the paperwork. She said it happens all the time. People start a nonprofit because they want to do something good, and the forms are the last thing they think about. They're thinking about the kiln, not the 990.
That's the long tail in a nutshell. Good intentions, broken kiln, wrong tax form. And the person who can fix the kiln isn't the person who can fix the tax form, and neither of them is getting paid enough.
The funny thing is, the donor who funded most of our programs, not the banker, a different one, he wanted to see impact data for a mural project. He wanted to know how many children's lives were measurably improved by painting a wall. He wanted a number.
What did you tell him?
I made up a number. I'm not proud of it. But you can't measure a mural. You can't quantify what happens when a kid spends 3 afternoons painting something that stays on a wall for 20 years. The grant required a number, so I gave them a number. I think I said something like, 47 children demonstrated improved self-esteem as measured by pre- and post-project surveys. There were no surveys.
That's honest, and probably not uncommon.
The mural's still there, by the way. 20-something years later, the donor's impact report is in a landfill somewhere. The mural outlasted the metrics.
The mural outlasted the metrics. That's almost a thesis statement for this whole conversation.
Most things do. The kiln broke, The reports got thrown away, the tax forms got corrected, but the mural is still on that wall. Kids still walk past it every day.
That's a good note to land on. The tension between the thing itself and the measurement of the thing that's been there since the first patron asked an artist, "What am I getting for my money?" And the honest answer, then and now, is often something that will outlast the question.
If you take one thing from this, it's that the non-profit sector is a mirror of how we value things that can't be priced. From a cathedral dome to a code base to a mural on a wall, the impulse to fund something that won't turn a profit is ancient. What changed is the scaffolding we built around it. The scaffolding makes the sector possible at scale, but it also creates friction between the thing and the measurement of the thing.
That scaffolding, the tax code, the foundations, the grant applications, the logic models, it both enables and constrains. It makes the sector possible at scale, and it also buries the thing it's supposed to support under 30 pages of paperwork about a kiln. The question is whether the scaffolding is supporting the building or just getting in the way.
The question Daniel's prompt leaves hanging is whether the lineage holds. As non-profits digitize, as governance models like DAOs emerge, as the sector globalizes, does the thread from Medici to Mozilla keep running, or does it break? I suspect the impulse survives. The structures around it, those are up for grabs. The scaffolding might change, but the urge to fund something that doesn't have a price tag, that seems pretty durable.
The long tail's fragility is the part that keeps me up. The big foundations and universities will be fine. They have endowments and development offices and lawyers on retainer. It's the after-school art program with a broken kiln and a founder who filed the wrong form. That's where the sector's real value lives, and that's where it's most vulnerable. The mural outlasts the metrics, but only if someone keeps the lights on long enough to paint it.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumintop for producing, and for the grant writing confession. You did what you had to do for the kiln.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Try not to break any kilns in the meantime. And if you do, try to enjoy writing the logic model.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.